From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Oren Durrell, Foreign Affairs Reporter for USA Today. Our moderator is Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist, David Rennie.
Good day, everyone, and here are the issues. With the threat of mass deportation looming over hundreds of thousands of immigrants, President Donald Trump brought confusion to talks with Republican and Democratic leaders, including using a vulgar term for African countries and Haiti. 1 million copies of Fire and Fury, a gossipy book that portrays Donald Trump as ignorant and despised by his own staff, sold in its first 4 days on sale. Mr. Trump called it fake news, but a real-life ally, Stephen Bannon, lost his media job for talking to the book's author. Oprah Winfrey, a television star and self-made billionaire, sparked calls to run for the White House in 2020 after she made a fiery speech about women's equality. North and South Korean officials met for the first time in more than 2 years, and the North agreed to send a large delegation to next month's Winter Olympics in South Korea. And Malaysia agreed to pay an American firm up to $70 million if it finds the remains of a Malaysia Airlines plane missing since 2014. So it's a busy week here in Washington. It's a week, I think, where we journalists feel once again like kind of cats being distracted with a kind of cat toy that the president has been sending us running this way and that. But immigration, Linda, is on the president's agenda because there are some hard deadlines that affect hundreds of thousands of people living in this country. Will they retain their legal protections or not? That has brought the president and congressional leaders together for the kind of meetings that presidents and congressional leaders have all the time in normal American politics. Mm-hmm. But when the meeting started, it didn't feel that normal. Talk us through at least some of what's been happening in this kind of roller coaster week.
Well, everybody's talking about a term that we can't use on VOA radio. We'll call it bleep hole. Google it if you want to know what he said. He used a very vulgar term in referring to Africa, Haiti, countries that he apparently does not want immigrants from those countries in the United States. This has revived the whole question of is Donald Trump racist? But this is, and that pleases his base. So his base is already excited. He's, quote, telling it like it is. But this is not really what's important. We've had this debate many times before. What's really important are a number of things. One, is the government going to shut down soon? They need to reach an agreement on funding. And what is going to happen to all those immigrants? We have the dreamers, the young undocumented immigrants who were brought into the country as children, who now face potential deportation if Congress can't reach an accommodation for them. We also have the ending of temporary protected status for some immigrants from Haiti, El Salvador. They also face deadlines. A group of senators visited with the president in the Oval Office where he made the offensive comment. They had a plan to solve these issues. He has rejected it. The short answer is stay tuned.
So, Oren Durrell, let's break this down. So, Donald Trump is basically, as president, he has to deal with the fact that previous American governments, both Republican and Democrat, have offered kind of a generous welcome to certain groups. They had people who survived an earthquake in El Salvador, who've been allowed to live here legally but not given citizenship. You had a group of people from Haiti, again, who survived an earthquake, were given protections. You have, as Linda says quite rightly, hundreds of thousands of people who came as kids without the right papers, but the idea is it's not their fault that they came as kids. Their parents brought them. So they were given protections and allowed to stay and work here by President Obama. So that kind of legacy of generosity is something that President Trump has been threatening to tear up, to scrap. Has President Trump been completely consistent all week? Can you say President Trump is consistently on the side of the hardest of hardliners, or has he actually kind of blown hot and cold this week?
So he has he's indicated that he's willing to cut a deal on DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals.
So this is the hundreds of thousands of people who arrived as kids.
People who came here as children and have been raised in the United States and gone to their only country they know, basically, is the United States. And previous administration, Obama's administration, created this program saying that they can stay and maybe someday get citizenship. And Trump has said that he's open to that this week, but only if his wall with Mexico is funded. This group of six senators that came forward came up with a plan for $1.5 billion for the wall, plus another $1 billion for other security measures, something that Trump would accept as
a wall. Classic kind of Washington compromise, yeah. Something for each side.
Right. So the thing is that Trump has said, yeah, you know, we can work out a deal. He's willing to accept DACA, but there are other things that he wants to get rid of. Which is the what they call chain, what the Republicans call chain migration, and what others call family unification migration, where American citizens and people who've been naturalized American citizens can bring their family members, a certain number of family members in. It can be kind of a mushrooming thing. Some people say that needs to be reined in. He wants to end that altogether. Also, the diversity lottery program. This is a program that was created to bring in more people from other parts of the world that weren't being represented in the immigrant community. And this 50,000, I think, annual visas. The group of six senators wanted to change that, so half of that would be applied to the people that were brought in by these protections that you mentioned earlier, the people from the earthquake countries.
And Linda, let's kind of take a step back and work out what is the... We're in Washington, so we talk about politics. What is the politics of this? Basically, one of the things I think that's going on is, for a long time, Republicans have made quite a lot of headway by talking about illegal migration. But they would always say, but legal migration, people who want to come here the right way, use the right routes and work, we love them. We have nothing against immigrants. But if you look at, as Oren says absolutely rightly, President Trump and some of his allies in the Republicans, they're actually talking about scrapping some of the legal routes, mm-hmm. and this big fuss about him being so insulting about Haiti or countries from Africa, is essentially seems to be moving into the terrain of saying it's not just illegal immigrants that he mm-hmm. dislikes. It's that America has, you know, a smart, tough, selfish America looking out for American interests mm-hmm. wouldn't be taking legal migrants from bad countries, from poor countries, from backwards countries. Is that what's going on this week? And does that take us into new terrain?
It's actually not new terrain. One of Donald Trump's most important advisors, Stephen Miller, a young populist nationalist activist, he many months ago came into the briefing room and talked about how we need to cut back on legal immigration, which, as you say, is quite eye-popping, given that America is a country built on immigration, whether it's legal or illegal. His point was that even legal immigrants are taking jobs away from Americans. Now, where he gets that, none of us can really tell, because we have nearly full employment in this country. Maybe people don't have the jobs they want, but we have a very low unemployment rate. But this is what this really is about, is getting Donald Trump back to his populist, nationalist message, which is the message that got him elected.
Because, Linda, it was interesting that a couple of days into these immigration talks, Donald Trump, having said, as Oren said, some quite friendly things about the kids who came the wrong way and he was going to let them stay, you saw some very important conservative TV stations mm-hmm. like Fox News attacking the president, which they very rarely do, mm-hmm. and saying he was being soft on immigration. Very soon after he's being attacked for being soft on immigration, he says this very, very rude thing about African countries and Haiti. Is that a coincidence?
I don't think so. Donald Trump he's a fascinating character. He, in a way, we're not sure what he believes. Donald Trump says things. He was a Democrat for, frankly, most of his adult life. He wasn't a nationalist populist. He's from New York City. He's very, you could say, even cosmopolitan in a way, in kind of his view of the world. He's comfortable with gay people. He's comfortable with black people. All of a sudden, he's adopted this persona of nationalism and populism, but sometimes he lets that slip. And as you say, to keep his base happy, he has to regularly bring that back just to quiet his critics.
So we find ourselves discussing this immigration meeting, but there's also been a book that's been selling. It's now sold more than 1 million copies.
Can I add one sentence to the immigration thing? So he mentioned this thing about these countries, Haiti and these African countries. In almost the same sentence, he said, you know, we should be having people, we should be bringing in people from countries like Norway. And I think what he's getting at, and he's parroting or repeating something that is out there, that the, you know, and the White House came out with a statement saying, well, what we want is immigration that's going to grow the economy and it's going to add to the economy and people that will assimilate. So there's an element of this that, you know, they're trying to paint this as maybe an economic approach.
Sure, and I'm sure that if you watch Fox News this morning, people are defending the president, saying everyone knows that Norway is a better place than Haiti. That's common sense. So why wouldn't you want people from Norway? Well, presumably, if you're looking at America's history, though, you say that America's genius is not taking immigrants from the richest to most successful countries in the world. It's taking people from anywhere and turning them into Americans. That's the American genius that Donald Trump is scorning. But let's turn to this book, Fire and Fury. It's not a great book. The guy who wrote it does not have a great record as a journalist, but he has spoken to a lot of people in the White House. What is the image of Donald Trump that comes out of this book that has now sold more than 1 million copies in the first kind of week on sale?
It's an image of a person who is who's a self-aggrandizer, who is ignorant about the issues, whose family and close advisors are rolling their eyes and shaking their head when he speaks, and of a man who whose repetitions of phrases has become so alarming that it's gone from every 30 minutes he repeats what he says to every 10 minutes he's repeating what he says.
Well, we need to come back to that important thought, but we'll expand on that when we come back from a short break.
This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. A reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Oren Durrell, Foreign Affairs Reporter for USA Today. Our moderator is David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist.
So just before the break, we were talking about Fire and Fury, this big gossipy book that is selling so much. Linda, Oren was making the point that they don't just say he's kind of an unusual president, the people who've spoken to the author of this book. People, you know, that he's repeating himself a bit more often, that he doesn't take in information, he doesn't like to read anything. People are starting to have a discussion, fairly or unfairly, about whether he's actually mentally fit to be president. Is that right? Is that normal?
This is a huge topic of discussion in Washington, and it's, as you say, it's raised questions over whether that's even appropriate. Is Donald Trump crazy? We don't know, and we're not qualified to discuss that. There's this thing called the Goldwater Rule from the American Psychiatric Association that forbids psychiatrists from analyzing from afar, sort of armchair analysis of people's mental competency. The psyche of Donald Trump is a fascinating subject, and whether he's sane or not, in a way, is irrelevant. He was elected by the American people. We have mechanisms for removing somebody from office. They can be impeached. We can invoke the 25th Amendment, with a very complicated process. We're nowhere close to either. So I think we have to accept Donald Trump as he is and work around that, and that's what we're seeing from his staff. As for this book, Steve Bannon was the one, this now former aide to Trump, major strategist for his campaign, and then
so this is the main casualty of this book.
The main casualty, exactly.
Is a guy who's lost his big media job this week for talking to the author.
I mean, he's been taken down completely, and this just proves that Donald Trump is a survivor. He always gets the last laugh. He beat all 16 primary opponents when he was running for president. He beat Hillary Clinton, and now he's beating Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon is unemployed, having gone from the pinnacle of power at the president's
elbow. So he ran the president's campaign. He was the chief strategist in the White House. He ran this big conservative media organization. But because he spoke to the author of this kind of tell-all book,
it's because of what the author quoted him as saying.
And what did he say that got him into so much trouble?
Well, he said that the meeting that the president's family members set up with this Russian lawyer in Trump Tower.
During the campaign,
supposedly to get dirt on Hillary Clinton. He used the word treasonous and unpatriotic. He referred to them as, you know, that action is the kind of an example of the brain trust that he had on his campaign. He's talking about the president's children and son-in-law. And, you know, we know that the president is very sensitive about his family.
There's a sense, isn't there? Is it right, Linda, that in some ways this is not like reporting on a White House. It's like reporting on a kind of royal court. And there's a kind of elderly king mm-hmm. who has a bad temper and who's very unpredictable. And Steve Bannon, this guy who's just lost his job, his offence was that he criticised the prince and princess.
It's almost a form of lèse majesté. I say, having just been in Thailand, where it's literally illegal to speak out against the king. But you're right. I mean, he more than, and in addition to saying that there was treasonous behavior by Trump family members, Steve Bannon also, 5 months after the firing of the FBI director, he was predicting the collapse of Trump's presidency, and he was saying that Trump had, quote, lost it. So he went right to Trump's competency, and I think that did him in.
So let's talk about what this tells us about American politics and the American electorate, because a counter-argument is that very little of what is in this book is a complete surprise if you were paying attention during the election. America knew that Donald Trump was a very unusual man. And now we see talk on the Democratic side that maybe the way to beat Donald Trump in 2020 is to choose someone like Oprah Winfrey, a self-made billionaire, talk show host, big celebrity. Is that where American democracy is going right now? That the only way to beat a TV star celebrity like Donald Trump is to choose another TV star celebrity like Oprah? Do you think that this is just kind of New Year nonsense, or that even if Oprah never runs, it tells you something about where politics is right now, that some quite serious people paid at least some attention to the idea that this new TV star should be Donald Trump's opponent?
Well, I think that Oprah Winfrey for president, that idea has been around for longer than just since the speech that she made, and longer even than just when Donald Trump ran for president. So that idea has been around for a while. How serious people are taking it, I think that there's certainly a sense, a continuing sense of shock in certain quarters of the country about Donald Trump winning the presidency and how he did it and how to counter that.
Very briefly, do you think Oprah Winfrey tells us something? The fact that people are talking about it tells us something?
It does, but it's pretty alarming. I mean, you have people alarmed by the election of an unqualified celebrity as president. So what are Oprah's qualifications? She's never served in public office. She has no experience in government. She's rich. I mean, she has in some ways the same qualifications as Donald Trump. Maybe she's a little less flaky, but she also hasn't been investigated. I mean, there are many things in her background that could come back to bite her. And I think it is a sign of how sort of celebrity crazy the country is. But I think we're seeing some sobering up after that.
So let's turn to a very sober subject, which is North Korea, a country which is busy developing the kind of nuclear weapons that could be fired at across the world, including reaching America, which could trigger a war. So it couldn't be a more serious subject. There is a sense here in Washington that there's a slight sense of relief that North and South Korea have been talking even about something as anodyne as the Winter Olympics, Arundel, because, you know, back a month and a half ago, people were very, very scared in this town that the North and South weren't talking, that the North didn't seem to want to talk to China, did not seem to want to talk to South Korea, didn't want to talk to the Americans, that it was just kind of barreling down a path towards confrontation. So now we see North and South Korea talking for the first time in more than 2 years. How did that go?
So the talks went pretty well. The North Korea came forward and said, we want to send a delegation. We want to send athletes. It'd be the first time they've done that, sent someone to South Korea, athletes for South Korean Olympics in South Korea for a very long time. The South Koreans have been asking very much to start a dialogue with the North Koreans, and they brought up some issues of family reunification, and even, they asked to continue talks about stability on the Korean Peninsula and denuclearization. We don't know how the South Koreans responded to that.
How did the North Koreans respond when the South Koreans brought up the nuclear question
as
opposed to the Olympics? Well, no, the North Koreans, didn't we see the North Koreans criticize and say that's totally unacceptable to raise the nuclear question?
So Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, has come out and said, he has said repeatedly that he's not denuclearizing and that that's not an option, and that the only time that they'll be willing to talk to the United States or to anyone else about their nuclear program is once they've reached their goal of a weapon that can reach, that can deliver a nuclear warhead to Washington, basically.
Linda, from the American perspective, is there a sense that these kind of talks, it's slightly uncomfortable, which is, on the one hand, America, officials in Washington are very glad to see the two Koreas talking because the kind of the extreme tensions are lowered a bit. Mm-hmm. But there's always that fear that if North Korea and South Korea start talking without America in the room, that then there's a kind of wedge being driven between America and its ally South Korea. Is that a kind of real fear that the South Koreans could be seduced into giving concessions that America would not like?
I think that is a fear, but I don't think it's a significant fear. I think the foreign policy establishment in Washington, including, say, Defense Secretary, Secretary of State, are relieved that that the tensions have backed down, and they're happy to have South Korea really lead the way on this. I mean, they're the ones sitting right on North Korea's border. We're half a world away, and I think for everybody it's a big relief. I will also point out that it's looking like some of the top American officials are going to stick around for a while. After all this breathless speculation about, say, Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, leaving by the end of the year, he's now saying he's going to stay for another year. This is also, I think, promoting stability within the national security world in Washington. And Donald Trump and North Korea, South Korea, he's saying that he's friends with Kim Jong-un. And
yet he is threatening to use military force.
And yet he's threatening to use...
If Kim Jong-un tests a weapon that can hit America.
Right, so go ahead.
So even Donald Trump, even President Trump, has praised these talks and praised the fact that the North Koreans are going to send athletes to the Olympics. But the talks represent a real threat also because the North Koreans can use these talks to create kind of a veneer of getting along with everybody and of being cooperative, while at the same time continue to develop nuclear weapons. There was a report this week about tunneling that's being done at the nuclear site where they test their nuclear weapons underground. That new stuff is being pulled out of the ground. Which looks like it could be a preparation for another test, possibly. No one in North Korea is saying that they're going to stop their program and slow it down. And while these talks are going on, it makes it very difficult. At some point, the U.S. administration will have to make a decision what their bottom line is.
Let's turn finally quickly to Malaysia. So it's a story that's fallen from the headlines in some countries, but in Malaysia it's still a terrible tragedy.
Right.
This plane went missing in 2014. What has the Malaysian government announced this week?
So they've made a deal with an American firm that is allowing it to continue to search for the wreckage of the flight. If they find it, they get a huge payout. I think, what is
and
it,
$70 million?
$70 million
if they find it quickly, isn't that right?
Right. This is, I guess, a good thing. I mean, the victims' families want closure on this. The world is a big place, but it's not infinite, and it's got to be somewhere.
And the new trick is that they're going to use this swarm of drones that they're going to search the seabed. What's that about?
So they're using a whole bunch of autonomous, non-tethered autonomous drones that will be simultaneously searching. But the area that they're searching is 9,700 square miles. It's an enormous area.
But it's like eight of these underwater kind of robot drones.
So they'll be searching. But it's a underwater, very mountainous area under very, very deep underwater. So there's a lot of searching to do. But they're also searching a new area that's a much further north than what they were searching before.
And if they find nothing, do they get paid anything?
They get paid nothing if they find nothing.
Well, let's wish them luck, because at least the closure for their families would be something worth paying for. That's all the time we have. Thanks to Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today, and Linda Feldman, Washington bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm David Rennie of The Economist. Thanks for listening.